Hello, America, and to our friends around the world. They're not real numerous these days, but welcome to the Common Sense Show. Everybody's welcome here. We're so glad you're here. We're the show that's freeing America one enslaved mind at a time. And this is a show that's going to do some historical unenslaving. There was some controversy on the Vince Foster murder before, but it didn't get the coverage it deserved. And now, in retrospect, it is going to get the coverage. And we're going to get down to some things. And I'm going to say this to you. With all the controversy surrounding the Charlie Kirk assassination, what Joe Kent has said publicly a couple of times now about the, shall we say, not being transparent with evidence and allowing a real investigation, we can't study things like this too much. There's great utility in this, and I really have used the JFK assassination faux pas to really kind of open up Charlie Kirk, and I think this is going to be a big contributor as well. Our guest is John H. Clark. He's an attorney, and he's got a lot to say on this. But before we join John, just remind you, we're coming to you from the Noble Gold Studios, and the banks are in some trouble because the economy is in trouble thanks to the war, and there's no end in sight right now. So what are you going to do? Well, if your retirement's associated with the bank, they can keep it. Dodd-Frank 2010, UCC code section 8, you're an unsecured creditor. Now, I don't think they would keep the whole thing. I hope they wouldn't, but they could bail you in. They could take a percentage. Do you really want to risk that? Well, Noble Gold can set you up to where you back up your retirement that you now own with precious metals, an appreciating asset. And they have a lot of other services too. And I speak from experience. I'm a 9-year client of Noble Gold. I'm going to give you a number to call, 877-646-5347, 877-646-5347. Well, John Clark's first-time guest, and he's a seasoned attorney. He's a member of the District of Columbia Superior Court Fiduciary Panel, specializing in complex litigation, federal oversight, can't get enough of that, and civil rights matters. Over his career, John has pursued numerous high-profile freedom information lawsuits, including cases related to unpatriated American POWs, and that used to be an issue close to my heart, still is, from both the Korean and Vietnam Wars. And he has really taken on a lot, and I don't want to waste a lot of our valuable time going into everything he's done, because that could be a whole show into itself. We will tell you how you can find John's website before we complete the interview. John, welcome to the show. So glad to have you on. And I have to say, I've talked about Vince Foster on this show in the past, and it really hasn't drawn the attention I think that it should. Why do you think this case is important that we should be talking about it 3 decades after the fact?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. The truth really matters, and it really tells us a lot about our democratic institutions, this case in particular. And yes. But before we get started, let me give your listeners and viewers a kind of a thumbnail of who Vince Foster was and where he was found and when. Yes. He was the deputy White House counsel under Bill Clinton. He came to Washington about a month or maybe a month and a half after Bill Clinton was sworn in. He was a partner at the Rose Law Firm, very, very close with Hillary Clinton, very close. And, of course, he knew from Arkansas Bill Clinton as well. And on July 20th, 1993, he was found in Fort Marcy Park, which is about 7 or 8 miles from the White House. A telephone call went in reporting the dead body. And believe it or not, to this day, we don't know who this anonymous caller was. But let me tell you what did happen to Vince Foster. He was driven to the park by somebody. He didn't drive his own car. His car was not in the lot. And he was shot with a small caliber weapon in the neck, just under the jawline, when the bullet went up into his brain and there was no exit wound. The weapon or the ammunition in the weapon is a small caliber weapon, probably a 22, and it was had a light powder charge, and that is used to prevent a blowback from getting onto the shooter. So that's essentially what happened to him. So we can talk about the various aspects of the case, and the forensic evidence is really very, very telling.
The forensic evidence, as I remember now, remember, we're going way, way back, so I'm testing my memory here, but I remember something, I think it was on Nightline with Ted Koppel, that the one of the anomalous things that they found with Vince Foster is that his glasses, after being shot in the head, his glasses were still on his face.
No, his glasses were found 13 feet below his feet. Okay. Uprange from that, you would think that if he were to shoot himself, the glasses would go in the direction of the shot, but they were found with ball powder on them, and ball powder is the gun that was ultimately recovered from his hand had sphere powder. It was not ball powder. The one spent and one unspent cartridge in the revolver, again, that was ultimately recovered from his hand was not the one that killed him. That was loaded with Remington, and Remington has never used ball powder.
That's amazing. So a fake gun, a substitute that didn't match, was planted.
Yes, the police planted that, and we know that from a number of sources, number of reasons. But one of the reasons is that the prosecutor who was assigned to the case, his name is Miguel Rodriguez. He said in a 30-page memorandum that he wrote, memorandum to file, but of course Ken Starr got a copy of it, said that the police had staged the crime scene. And initially what they did was they took the initial photographs, staged the crime scene, placed a revolver in his hand, and then photographed it. And then they buried the initial photographs that were taken. And that included an entire roll of 35 millimeter, which they said was underexposed, which it was not. Because the photographer, the evidence technician who took those photographs, said that he saw some of them when he was being interviewed, some of the photographs that he was taken, and he was interviewed by the FBI, and I'm quoting him, he said, "They look good to me." So, and then at least it looks like 13 photographs, Polaroid photographs, also vanished.
That's really interesting. You know, I'm pretty sure Ted Koppel reported what I said. It just comes down to misinformation, I guess, about the glasses still being on his head. That to me really stuck. I said, that's just not possible. So I guess he was reporting misinformation. The substitute gun is telling. I mean, that is really telling. How could they be so sloppy?
I think they were so slop. Well, for one, I think it's important to go back to that 911 call that was placed. And again, we don't know who placed that call. The body was not ready for its discovery. That 911 call went in at 6 p.m. on a Tuesday evening. And there's a sign when you drive into Fort Marcy Park. It's a very small park with a small parking lot. It said, and rarely occupied. Nobody ever goes there. There's almost nothing to see. But in any event, when you drive in, there's a sign out in the front that says closed at dark. So what they had, clearly what happened was they thought that they would have, or the plan was to have another 2 hours to stage the crime scene before Fairfax County Fire and Rescue showed up, and that was a big problem for those who were covering up this crime. And the reason was, and when I say it wasn't ready for its official discovery, I mean they hadn't done anything to prep the body or the. For example, his car was not in the parking lot. He didn't drive there. He had no car keys. There was a visible bullet wound in his neck. They had not yet placed the revolver in his hand, and the Fairfax County Fire and Rescue told us all of those things. And again, we don't know who to even discover. Why would somebody do that anonymously? not one of, and apparently it was because whoever that person was saw some things that the FBI does not want to be public.
Jumping ahead just for a second here, are there suspects today that people point to?
Well, there are a number of theories about why he was killed and who killed him. But, you know, we spent the three of us, myself and my client, Patrick Knowlton, and my friend, the researcher, Hugh Turley, spent 17 months writing a review of the independent counsel's report. And no, we don't know why he was killed. Or who killed him. But what we do know for certain that it was a murder.
Yeah, I'll tell you, two things in my memory come back to this. Bill Clinton's curiosity. One was he wanted to know who killed Kennedy. And two, what's the real story on UFOs? Those are the two anomalies I remember. And I'm not sure if in any way they relate to this. Are there any good guesses as to why he would be murdered?
No, not in my opinion. There are some leads. Let me tell you about one of these leads, which I found particularly interesting. And this was I'm holding in my hand a cover sheet that was recovered from the National Archives. And what it is, it says Child Abduction and Serial Killer Unit, Questions for a Suicide Expert, Vincent Foster Death Investigation. Now, what the hell is this doing in the investigative record of Vince Foster? I don't know. This was dated March 11, 1996. And this and virtually everything that we're going to talk about and all of the evidence, including surreptitiously taped telephone conversations with both Brett Kavanaugh and, more importantly, his predecessor, are at the website vincefostermurder.com.
Okay, so Brett Kavanaugh factored into this because I believe Ken Starr was investigating the murder slash suicide, and Brett Kavanaugh was his main assistant. How did that come about?
Well, that's a good question. Miguel Rodriguez was initially assigned to investigate the Foster murder or Foster death, and he was doing so and doing a very good job, and he had impaneled a grand jury. And he was really making some real headway. But what happened was the FBI, he couldn't get subpoenas served. The FBI would serve them. He was threatened with his life. He said that his family was threatened. And how do we know all this? Because we have surreptitiously taped telephone conversations with him, which appear, both the conversations and the transcripts appear at vincefostermurder.com. So in any event, he was run out of the office, essentially. He was forced to resign. And so after he left, the independent counsel, Ken Starr, appointed Brett Kavanaugh to take his place.
Well, and did Brett Kavanaugh participate in the cover-up?
He did. The first thing he did was he dismissed the grand jury so that he got impaneled a new grand jury so that the new grand jury had he didn't know anything about all of the evidence that Miguel Rodriguez had presented to the grand jury.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, he would have to start over because he had a poisoned grand jury that was exposed to some facts. What happened to Miguel? What position did he hold before he was the chief investigator? What happened to him after the fact? Did he become a whistleblower at all?
Oh yeah, he tried to be a whistleblower. In any event, he's a U.S. attorney for the Northern District of California. He's investigated a number of murder cases. He's very well qualified. And after he was run out of the office, he returned to the Northern District of California, where he practices, where is he a prosecutor to this day. Now, you asked him, was he trying to be a whistleblower? Yeah, and these tapes that we have of him, again, surreptitiously taped telephone conversations are really quite telling. After he was run out of the office, he contacted over, and this is a quote from him, over 100 journalists. He spent 9 hours on the phone with Steve Levitan of the New York Times. He names a number of the publications that he talked to. He said that a number of the journalists that interviewed him wrote the stories, but they were sent to the editors, and the editors killed every single one of them. So nothing appeared. And there's another thing that is really very telling about the news media. You know, the news media in this case acted as one would expect a public relations firm to act throughout the course of this 4 years of various investigations. And during that time, the FBI leaked out to the news media that federal officials were soon to conclude that Vince Foster took his own life. He committed suicide. Now, that was the longest sustained press leak in U.S. history. And it was, you know, so people who were around at that time and were paying attention to the news media have probably heard hundreds of times that Vince Foster had committed suicide. So in any event, he was a would-be whistleblower. And again, his taped telephone conversations, surreptitiously taped, are on the website.
To me, here's where I think the person in the audience is right now with this interview. How does a guy get 7 miles from his work location? He has no car, no car keys. So are we to believe that he said, "Drive me to this park. I want to do myself in"? I mean, this doesn't even make sense.
Well, the official version is that he drove his own car, but it wasn't there. Everybody showed up, the park police and the Fairfax County Fire and Rescue. His car wasn't there.
Did they try to place a car there after the fact?
They placed a car there. A car was there, and it was an Arkansas Honda, and it was a 1983 or a 1984 Honda. And we know that because Patrick Knowlton went to the FBI lab, the car color panel section, and it was a very unusual color with and it wasn't shiny. It was like matte, and it was brown, a matte brown, very unusual for a car to be that color. So he picked out the car color panels, and the car color panels corresponded to a Honda's only for the years 1983 and 1984. Now, Vince Foster's children, the car that was actually recovered, it wasn't his car, it was in his name, but he didn't drive it, was a 1989 car, and it was silver. And again, the car that had the Arkansas Honda was an older car, and it was brown.
So was that car at the 83 car, was that at his residence, and they took the wrong car by mistake trying to cover this up?
No. No, he drove a Lexus with his wife, and his children shared young adults shared a car, and that was a 1989 car.
Right. Okay.
And so the 1983, 1984 car, we don't know whose car that was, but it was not Vincent Foster's.
Oh, boy. These things have so many, you know, just to bring in just one quick anecdote. At the so-called murder scene from Lee Harvey Oswald, they found 3 shell casings all lined up right next to each other. That's what this puts me in the mindset of. So contrived. They couldn't even get the car right. But the whole thing doesn't make any sense. I'm baffled because I got it. He was also, you know, wasn't he a childhood friend of Bill Clinton?
I don't believe that he was a childhood friend of Bill Clinton. They're both the same age. And at one point during their childhood, Vince Foster lived in a very nice home in Little Rock. And Bill Clinton's apartment building was the property there was bordering Vince's family home, but I don't think they were friends. They did not move in the same circles. I mean, Vince Foster went to a private school, and Bill Clinton went to public school. So they may have met each other as children. I'm not sure about that, but they certainly knew each other very well as adults. He was Vince was a partner in the Rose Law Firm, and very, very close to Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, there's also something else that's sticking in my memory I want to ask you about because I never had it resolved in my mind. Wasn't there a controversial movement of sensitive files by Hillary Clinton related to Vince Foster?
Well, there were the, Congress had hearings, and hopefully we'll get to that. But one of the hearings they had, set of hearings, was Vince was the removal of documents from Vince and Foster's office, and they had a staffer was seen taking out a big stack of documents. So Congress had an entire hearing on that, but they had the wrong search. We know from a record of the Secret Service that the FBI had been in there before this search by Helen Dickey, the staffer. So they, typically Congress had the wrong search. But I'm not sure that there's really anything particularly telling about those removal of those documents.
Some people at that time, though, I remember, made a big deal about it. They wanted to know what was in the files. Was she trying to hide something? I do remember there was speculation about that. You know what's really sad, though, for Miguel is there was no internet then. If there was an internet like today, his account would be all over the media.
Yeah, I'm surprised that it isn't now with the advent of alternative media. That's why I'm so appreciative to be on your show. But you would think that alternative media would be all over this. But so far, I don't understand it. They have not been.
Well, he may have gone through enough with the threats against him and his family. He's decided that's a chapter I'm going to leave in the past, and I would understand that.
Well, he tried. He really tried. He gave it the college try, and then he kind of threw in the towel. I went to go see him in Northern California, and he would not see me. I made the mistake of
Really?
telling him that I was coming.
Really?
But yeah, but and he, he was apparently, when Reed Irvine of Accuracy in Media taped all his telephone conversations, and he had numerous telephone conversations with Miguel Rodriguez. And he we fi I found out fairly recently that when he found out about those tape that it was certain that they were tapes and that they appear on the internet, he was not happy about that.
Okay, let's take Knowlton for a second. The eyewitness, there's some anomalies about failure to follow up with him, I understood. Can you just walk us through his role in all this and what we learned from him?
Yeah, I can certainly and I'm happy to do that. Let me digress just for a minute on that. In 1997, we call this the Great Suppression of 97. I submitted on Patrick's behalf, Patrick Knowlton's behalf, 20 pages to the independent counsel to the court, asking the court to order Kenneth Starr to attach my evidence. My submission to his report on the death of Vincent Foster as an appendix. And there's a provision for that in the independent counsel statute. And it's totally discretionary with the court. So I submitted it. The court granted my motion, said you attach this. And Ken Starr filed an opposition and a motion to reconsider. Both of which were denied, but that 20 pages is it's excerpts, photocopied excerpts of 20 federal investigative records showing five items of a murder cover-up, along with 11-page single-spaced letter, which undermines the whole Ken Starr's entire investigation, primarily focusing on how he used the FBI. To investigate when the FBI has been covering up. And in that, among that, is what happened to Patrick Knowlton. And so I have a copy of it right here, and I'll go through it with you. Sure. The first page, the exhibit one, attached to an 11-page single-spaced letter, is what happened, Patrick Knowlton, what happened to him when he was at the park. And I'm assuming you can see this. There are three cars in the lot. Patrick's, there's the Arkansas Honda, which is in black here. Then next to it is Patrick's car. And this, about 2.5 spots down, is another car, which was backed in with somebody sitting in it. So Patrick pulled into the park, facing a over an hour drive and backed up in traffic, and he needed to urinate. So he pulled into Fort Marcy Park to do so. Again, it's a very small park and very heavily foliated, and almost nobody ever goes there. So he pulled in, and like I said, this is his car, number two. So he got out of the car. He walked, and as he got out of his car, this car number three that was backed in was occupied, and the window went down. This guy was staring at him, giving him what he characterized as a menacing stare. So Patrick really didn't know what to make of that, but he figured, well, you know, what the heck? And he got out of his car, and you see these solid lines. He walked into the park. The first big tree, relieved himself and walked back into his car. And when he did, as he was walking back, he heard the car door close of this third car. And he didn't know whether or not maybe the guy was coming after him. He just didn't know. He was, you know, his senses were heightened. And so as he walked back, he thought that maybe even the guy, he couldn't see whether or not the guy was back in his car. So he thought that maybe the guy could be crouching between the two cars, between the Arkansas Honda and his car. So he walked around the back of the car and looked inside, saw some items in there, and got in his car. And as he got in his car, he could see that this guy in the third car was had gotten back in his car. So Patrick fired up his car and took off. And that was it. I mean, that's the only thing that he saw at Fort Marcy Park. So, the next day, he saw that Vince Foster was found dead at the park. He was in the park, so he called the park police to report what he had seen, and they never came to interview him or anything. They spent about 20 minutes or whatever it was, 10, 15 minutes over the phone, and they jotted down some of the details of what Patrick has seen. They got all the facts wrong and left out half of it. In any event, so that was it. And then 9 months later, he was interviewed by the FBI. They tried to convince him that the car that he saw, which was the 1983 or 1984, could have been Vince Foster's 1989 silver car. And Patrick wouldn't go along with it. He just flat out, he said, no, I don't care what you're. And they worked on him over and over again, asking him, is it possible? Is it, you know, is this, are you sure? You know, that sort of thing. And he stuck to a story. He said, yeah, you know, he has a very good memory. And he said, no, that just was not the car that he saw, period. This was the FBI investigation under Robert Fisk. And so October 13th.
Well, before you leave that, I want to go back to one thing. When sure. The FBI was interviewing Knowlton, where was the investigation into Vince Foster's death at? Had they come to the conclusion yet that it was suicide?
They came to the conclusion that it was suicide after the 16-day initial investigation.
Okay.
So this was investigation number two.
So the FBI is trying to close the loophole, in other words.
Yeah, and they were all over the case during the course of the first 16-day investigation. Okay. And remind me, because I want to talk about the investigative history, because it's very interesting. But in any event, so these FBI agents interviewed Patrick in 1994, a year after the death, and they tried to convince him that the car that he could have seen, they were showing him photographs, the car that he seen could have been Vince Foster's car, and he kept saying no. So what they did was they falsified the report, said that he identified it as a consistent with Vince Foster's car. So Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who was the Sunday Telegraph, a British newspaper, very prestigious, he was one of two investigative reporters looking into this, and he got the FBI 302 reports of Knowlton. They misspelled his name, but in any event, Ambrose finally located him and interviewed Patrick, and Patrick said, this is a lie. He said over and over again, this is a lie, that's a lie. He said that the FBI 302 reports are just filled with lies. So Ambrose wrote an article which appeared on this Sunday, London Sunday Telegraph. This was in 1995. It quoted.
Sorry, you froze up.
Huh?
Okay, you froze up. Go ahead. Yeah. He filed the report in 1995. Go ahead and take it from there.
Yeah. So, I take it you heard me. He was interviewed by Ambrose Evans Pritchard.
Right.
And Pritchard wrote the article saying that the FBI had lied about what he had seen at Fort Marcy Park. And Ambrose also wrote that the STARS FBI or STARS office had not even interviewed him and had not asked him to testify before the grand jury, and just kind of made light of what was going on with Ken Starr. So that newspaper appeared on a Wednesday. A Tuesday. The next Tuesday was the Sunday Telegraph. It appeared in U.S. newsstands on a Tuesday, and Patrick went down and got a hold of it. Because Ambrose had warned him and told him that it was coming, and he said that his life might be in danger. So, in any event, the Office of Independent Counsel prepared a subpoena for Patrick to testify before the Whitewater Grand Jury the very day that article appeared on U.S. newsstands, and I have a copy of the subpoena right here. And signed by Brett Kavanaugh with his telephone number right there. So to testify the following Wednesday, November 1, 1995, before the Whitewater Grand Jury. So Patrick was not happy about that. But in any event, he has a habit of taking walks from his apartment in Foggy Bottom to DuPont Circle. And so beginning the same day that he received the subpoena and was taking one of his walks, he was harassed over a 2-day period by no fewer than 25 men following him and staring at him. And later on, I submitted this report, or this appendix to the court. And among the exhibits, the exhibit number 2, is a map of the individuals where they were first seen and where they were and was it what and the statement that is attached to this map says during the course of the 2 days beginning the day that FBI agent Bransford served the secret grand jury subpoena, Patrick suffered the cumulative effect of intimidation by at least 25 men. They acted in rapid and coordinated fashion, obviously working in tandem, employing the same modus operandi of continuously staring and following. Of the first 25 men, 23 appeared within 5 minutes of his predecessor. 13 approached before his predecessor had departed. So what we have is the article that Ambrose wrote said that the man in Fort Marcy Park had been giving him a menacing stare. So who's going to believe somebody who says that recounts about a menacing stare and says that every time he leaves his apartment, there are strange men on every street corner following him and giving him menacing stares?
Sounds like he's paranoid. I agree.
Yeah, yeah. And also from this exhibit, it says, experts tell us that the technique is known to federal intelligence and investigative agencies and that its objects were twofold. One, to intimidate and warn Patrick in connection with his grand jury testimony, and failing that, to destabilize him and discredit his testimony before the grand jury.
Sure, sure.
So
this is so classic. I've run into this in other investigations. This classic. Lee Bauer, who was a witness to the Kennedy assassination, went through the similar harassment. I keep going back to Kennedy because I'm seeing real parallels here about the cover-up. And it was the FBI that tried to browbeat him before he gave testimony in the Warren Commission. And he just coincidentally, when he wouldn't change his story, died in a single car accident outside of Midlothian, Texas. Same thing. What ended up happening to Knowlton? Did he meet foul play or did he die of natural causes?
Sadly, he did pass away of natural causes in April.
Well, good that they didn't murder him. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Wow, this is...
We haven't spoken about the investigative history yet, have we? No.
No, not really.
Well, yeah, well, let me go through that.
We got about 12 minutes.
Okay,
I'm going to pause this just for a second here. Okay, so let's get into the investigation aspect of it.
Yeah, I wanted to talk briefly about the investigative history. The first investigation, well, for starters, the Presidential Assassination and Assault Statute, a part of the U.S. Code, mandates that the FBI investigate Vincent Foster's death. They take primary jurisdiction, but they did not take primary jurisdiction, or at least they told us they didn't. And so it was a park police investigation and was just 16 days long. They closed that investigation before they even tested the weapon to see whether or not it would fire. And their report was 3/4 of a page. It was almost, I mean, it's just essentially nothing in it. So then that closed up and they had the independent counsel. Independent counsel Robert Fisk investigate, and he used FBI agents, 6 FBI agents in the first page of his report to investigate this. And the FBI, during the course of the Park Police investigation, interviewed many more witnesses than the Park Police did. But they just said they were just helping, just following along, helping, when actually they were just covering it up. So then Robert Fisk was the actual independent counsel statute was reenacted. It's a 5-year sunset and it has to be reenacted. So they reenacted it. And so Robert Fisk wanted to be appointed as the independent counsel, but he was not. They appointed the 3-judge Court of Appeals panel, appointed Kenneth Starr. So Kenneth Starr investigated until 1997. He was appointed in 1994. So 3 years he allegedly investigated, and then he issued his suicide report. And we've already talked about how Miguel Rodriguez was run out of the office and Brett Kavanaugh has taken over. So those are the federal investigations. So really, the investigations was the FBI, second was the FBI, and third was the FBI. And actually, Ken Starr used the very same agents to investigate this case that had been investigating under Robert Fisk. Now, the public has also been told, in addition to those 3, that Congress has investigated twice. Not true. Just propaganda, disinformation. The Senate Banking Committee was set up under Resolution 223, which set their jurisdiction, their investigative jurisdiction. And their jurisdiction was whether or not the White House had interfered with the Park Police investigation. Now, most of the senators stipulated to suicide in their opening statements. So they did not investigate the death of Vincent Foster. And then the other one was the other investigation that the news media has been touting was an investigation by William Plinger, who was a congressman and a member of the the House Governmental Oversight. Now, what he did was he and some of his staff members interviewed some park police and interviewed some FBI agents. They didn't talk to any of the Fairfax County Fire and Rescue. They, of course, didn't talk to Patrick Nolan, but they wrote, he wrote an 8-page double-spaced conclusion that Vince Foster had committed suicide. And in 60 Minutes, they interviewed him. He said, well, why would you, a Republican, why would you, be a participant in the cover-up of a Democratic, administration? In any event, it's ridiculous. But in any event, so that's the investigative history. So in the short term, or the summary, first the FBI, second the FBI, third the FBI, Congress never investigated. But you wouldn't know that by reading the Washington Post or listening to NBC News. Mm-hmm. They say there are 5 separate investigations. This is a joke. So but before we move on to anything else, I want to make sure that I tell your listeners that at FBI – VinceFosterMurder.com appears this a lengthy volume, 500 pages, comparing this, critiquing the 114 double space page report of the Independent Counsel, which means the report of Brett Kavanaugh. So this proves that there's nothing that's true in this. And this might look a little bit intimidating, 500 pages, but it has 14 chapters, and all but 3 of them have summaries at the beginning of the chapters. And you would not believe like I said, it sounds like an exaggeration that nothing in this report is true, but this proves that nothing is true. And again, that is because when the 911 call went in, and the Fairfax County Fire and Rescue, along with the Park Police, responded, the body was not ready for its discovery.
I understand. That does make a lot of sense, the forensics thing. Okay. This is something I'm just dying to ask, though, because this just keeps nagging at me. Hillary Clinton moved those files for a reason. There was something in there. I just can't shake that feeling. And then the other thing I look at is, the motive. You know, why are they going to such lengths? I mean, they could have said, hey, he was carjacked, and he was murdered in this. But why are they insistent on a suicide? It's baffling. And I'm telling you, there's something there. And I'm going to go to what my gut tells me. I know from talking to a lot of people who have reason to know this, Clinton really wanted to know who killed John Kennedy. And I'm just wondering if the two of them didn't come across something that had to be buried. I don't know. But I just, there's got to be something that was being covered up. I mean, he's driven 7 miles from the White House. He's murdered. It's a sloppy crime scene. So it doesn't seem like it was a really well-planned event. It seemed to be rather spontaneous in the murder. That's my gut feeling. Do you have any notion about why he was killed?
You know, I don't know. Those files that you're referring to, I think, were billing records from the Rose Law Firm, and there may have been something about systematics in those billing records. That might be what it was. I don't know if you're familiar with systematics.
There was controversy. Didn't Hillary get disbarred over something connected with that law firm and her duties?
Not to my knowledge. You know, people say, well, you know, why would Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton have Vince Foster murdered? Well, we've gone through the investigative record, and there's no indication whatsoever that we could find in the public record that Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton had anything to do with the murder.
Yeah, and I'm with you on that. I think that that's probably true. But I think after the fact, with Vince Foster being dead, Hillary moving those files might have been a reaction to the death, and that's a panicked reaction to cover something up that she thinks might have had something to do with it. And I'm only guessing, but if I'm an investigator, that's where I'm going to start looking, is what's in those files. I'd like to know if it had anything to do with the murder. I don't think Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton had him murdered, though. I totally agree with you on that. I came to that conclusion a long time ago. But I do think it's something that they came across that was a threat to other people.
Yeah, very, very well may be true. You know, not in public, but in conversations with Hugh Turley and with others, we talk about the possible motive. But we don't have any evidence of who killed him or why. So it's not something that I'm, you know, going to talk about theories on a podcast, because I just don't, you know, we stick with what we know.
Listen, I understand why you're saying that, but it's always going to nag at me really why this happened. Because there's no question. I mean, you've turned this inside out and upside down. This man was murdered, and he was driven to a location where he was purposely murdered, and an obscure location where they, you know, the body wouldn't be found for a long time. They weren't counting on some guy coming in and urinating on a tree and then upsetting the apple cart. This is just bizarre, but it's bizarre behavior that Knowlton was harassed the way he was. See, when you put 25 people on one man who's not giving you the correct vehicle description, that's a panic reaction here, and they're desperate to cover something up.
Well, you know, they're just bureaucrats. If they just not done this intimidation, this harassment, they would have gotten away with it. I mean, you know, we wouldn't have gone forward. We filed a civil rights lawsuit, a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit. They had the litigation before the special division for the purpose of appointing in the counsels of the U.S. Court of Appeals. And we filed a total of 3 grand jury applications asking the judge to order the independent counsel to present evidence to the grand jury. And of course, those were denied. But we did have that initial success before the special division for the purpose of appointing independent counsels. And I would ask that if your listeners or viewers are interested in this, to go to vincefostermurder.com. It's all there.
Sure.
Every bit of it.
The one thing that I'm looking at, though, is that someone has to know why he was murdered. I'm kind of surprised it hasn't come out. And I'm going to tell you, this reminds me of, it brings in Joe Kent, you know, the guy that just resigned, and he said we weren't allowed to do a full investigation of Charlie Kirk's murder. And that was real clear a few months ago when they wouldn't let him investigate foreign involvement if there was any. It's the same thing. If the federal government would have not investigated Charlie Kirk's murder, which was a state crime, they had no business being involved, okay, then people like me wouldn't have 3 weeks after the fact said there's some problems here. And you're exactly right. If they would have just not lied and say, well, okay, we have a mistake in the vehicle description, but that doesn't change the overall facts, people wouldn't have asked questions. At least I don't think they would have.
No, even after Ambrose's article was published, if they had just not done anything, like I said, they would have gotten away with it.
Do you know what Vince Foster was working on his primary duties at that time?
No, I really don't. I do not. Deputy White House Counsel. I don't know.
Yeah, it just, like I said, I'm always going to have my suspicions it has something to do with Kennedy, because I know this was an obsession of Bill Clinton, and I know this for a fact. Clinton had gone to Washington, D.C. as part of Project Close Up when he was 13, and he shook John Kennedy's hand. So he felt an affinity, and this is something that I've had it explained to me by a couple of insiders who did not know each other, and I've gotten the same story. And there's just something there that just nags at me. But I get, you know, for now, we're just not going to know. But what I do appreciate that you've done is you have exposed the fact that this was an assassination, certainly a murder, and it was covered up, and we don't know why. We're out of time, but I wanted to make sure that we gave out your website one more time so people can go there.
Yeah, VinceFosterMurder.com. I have some of my other cases that appear on my own website, which is JohnHClarkLaw.com. So that's J-O-H-N, middle initial H, last name C-L-A-R-K-E, law, L-A-W.com.
Okay, very good. Very interesting, John. I appreciate you coming on. And if I have any follow-up, I'm going to call you. But anyway, thanks so much for being on the Common Sense Show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Okay, my pleasure. Dave Hodges here. I'm the host of the Common Sense Show. We have the show that is freeing America, one enslaved mind at a time. Thank you so much for joining us. We are brought to you by a product that will help you remove aches and pains. It's absolutely fantastic. It's from Magic Dicol, the Nanosoma product. This is the gel that you rub on your affected joints. You notice I put it into a shoulder and then later to a knee. Well, this grows pluripotent stem cells. And over time, it's not a tomorrow thing, but over time, you'll see relief. And for me, it took 6 to 8 weeks. And at the 8 week mark, I was virtually symptom free. It's absolutely fantastic. It's due to the pluripotent stem cell growth that this stimulates. You can get yours now by going to iwantmyhealthback.com/Dave Hodges. iwantmyhealthback.com/Dave Hodges. Well, we have something really interesting to share with you. And I'm going to show you this right up front. This is not good at all. At all. So what we're looking at here is the draft has been moved from 34 years of age to 42 years of age. The last time this was done was for Iraq and Afghanistan, although they ended up not needing it. Now, the approximate age for World War II was 40 years of age. So we're in that target zone. Do you understand that when enlistments plummet, and they are, they're going to have to reach into the civilians? And I've been telling you, close the window because the draft is coming, but this won't protect your youngsters. How many of you will leave the country? Are you already doing database searches for non-extradition agreements with foreign governments? Are you preparing to move all of your operations into these foreign countries to protect your young adult children? I suspect we're going to see a lot of it. Hey, listen to me. 100,000 people have left Israel, and for good reason. The war that should never have been fought. Now we're in it. We got to win it. But let me go through some of this that was sent to me by a very trusted source. Trump is expecting to need more troops for boots on the ground. We'll elaborate on that later. Operation Iraqi Freedom ended on December 18th, 2011, 8 years later, after Donald Rumsfeld said, this conflict could last 6 days, 6 weeks, but I doubt it'll be 6 months. It was, you jackass. It was 8 years. 8 years. Ladies and gentlemen, if we invade Iran, first of all, there'll never be a total victory. Secondly, it'll be like Vietnam, only worse because of the high-tech weapons we face, a greater population, and a more difficult terrain. This is really, really bad. Excuse me. Allergy season creeping up on me. Fortunately, I'm using the Nanosoma liquid spray, okay, and this boosts my immune system. I used to be a lot worse. I have a little cough, but I don't need medication. Yeah, I drink some water. I can clear it, and I'm fine. These products are great. What's not great is what's going to happen here. By the way, I'm hearing that, let's go back and look at it. Condoleezza Rice, she's consulting with Trump privately because she's a veteran of this. Listen, I knew her in passing. Very well thought of, highly intelligent, multiple skill sets, including that of like a concert pianist. And she seemed like a really good person. I didn't know her very well, but I got to tell you, she doesn't strike me as the warmongering type. I thought she was along for the ride in the Bush administration. And I did not blame her. I blamed Rumsfeld and Bush for the nonsense that went on in the Middle East. Weapons of mass destruction, of which there were none. We were lied into those wars in Afghanistan and Iran, and we're being lied into these wars. Wars, it's not going to stay in Iran, not unless we find a way out. Now, I'm going to give President Trump credit. I think he's realized the folly of his ways. He listened to Jared Kushner, who, if this goes out and plays out to its full fruition, he's going to make $7 billion. Stephen Witkoff, I don't know what he's going to make, but he's a real estate mogul. So obviously, he's in this for billions. And they lied to the president, and they said, Iran's ready to attack. We've got it on good authority. And then Netanyahu's telling him the same thing, and Trump, I think, hit the panic button, and this is what we did. Now we're looking for an off-ramp. Do we have an off-ramp? Well, we may very well have an off-ramp. But first, I have to tell you what's coming. And what's coming is how the battle plans are going to be laid out. That's taking clear shape. And it's because of my prior associations with military people, including someone that you know well, Doug Thornton. We're going to be talking about the unveiling of Operation Nitro Zeus in a little more detail than I've given before. We actually have unit names we can put into this, and we can tell you how this is going to work. But we're also going to tell you this is not the last stage of the conflict. Does it involve boots on the ground? And the answer is unequivocally, yes, it does. Stay tuned. More on this as we continue through our segments.